Hello, this is Matt Hale bringing you the Art Monthly talk show once again. That's a talk show which goes out as a podcast as well, but it's first broadcast on Resonance FM, which we've been doing for years and very pleased to do so. Today I'm joined by one person, Dave Beach, who's an artist and reader in art and Marxism at the University of the Arts London. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Matt.
We're recording this in the morning, fairly early, which is good for our brains. My brain usually works better in the morning. Dave is rubbing his eyes. Sorry, Dave. Let's hope that's the case for Dave. We're going to be discussing a feature by Dave, which is in the Art Monthly number 494, March 2026. So it's just come out, and we're doing this programme to expand on the thoughts in Dave's feature and to promote the issue. So thank you for listening, whenever that may be. Dave, your piece is called Still Lifescapes in the magazine. And I do want to talk about that word, lifescapes, because obviously that's a new one on me. But you're basically talking around still life, which is a kind of way of a particular kind of painting, which has been going on for many years. But before we just jump into doing that straight away, you say that your piece really came out of researching or was connected with researching the figural representation of working class women in still lives. And but I also know that you are an artist too, which, as it says in your bio. But is there a connection between what you make yourself, perhaps, and the kind of work that you end up talking about in this feature? I mean, I know you work, I think, primarily now on collage. Is that right?
Yeah, I call it montage. You know,
montage. Yeah, sorry
about the difference between the two. But I don't have a kind of programmatic relationship between what I write and what I do in the studio. But they do kind of blend into each other. Almost like without intention, you know, that when I'm in the studio and I'm working with images, because I work with a kind of whole, like, I've got like a library of books that I cut up that I've picked up from secondhand bookshops. And when I'm flicking through them, I think that I'm just like looking for something in particular, you know, like, you know, I'm looking for, I don't know, an image of someone carrying something, and I'm flicking through and I'm looking for something like that. And then when I find something, and then sometimes I'll find something which is exactly what I've been looking for, and I think, no, I'm not interested in that, and I carry on looking. And then I'll find something, and then I cut it out, and I'm thinking, oh, that relates to what I was talking about yesterday. And so it kind of catches me unawares in a way.
That's the best way, in a sense, because you are making art, so it's not like you're not writing a thesis or a doctorate or something, are you?
And so, sometimes if you try to force that, then it feels unnatural, it feels weird. So you know, I found that when I've really tried to sort of construct the meaning, then I, you know, quite quickly I'll hate that piece of work.
That does interest me.
Kind of catches me.
Yeah. Makes me think of, just to expand on that slightly, that and I'm probably a bit cynical about it, but research is obviously something that is, you know, many artists refer to doing research or are encouraged to talk in that sense or that way due to their link to the academic university, but they're doing it for their art. And sometimes you do see art that does seem to be rather illustrative of. So in a way, doing what you just described, you try not to do. And it's an interesting area.
I try not to do that. But I do find that, like, so it goes both ways. So if I'm like, you know, building images out of images, and I have a kind of little run of images, and they're all, I don't know, they're all landscapes, and I kind of think, oh, why am I picking out landscapes at the moment? And then I start thinking about it and spend time with those things and compare them to, why didn't I select that one? What's the difference between this one and that one? And I start to look at the whole range of landscapes that I've actually got available to me, and why am I picking out these? What's interesting about those? And then that can lead to me I don't know, reading about landscape or reading about nature or something like that. And then that can become a lecture I give or something like that. Do you know what I mean? Because you find that the work has pushed you into sort of considering something that you've always taken for granted or something like that.
Yes.
And so that's where this article on still landscape came from. Is for, I'm wondering, you know, basically it came from me noticing that, you know, after a certain, I don't know, over a couple of months or something, most of the montages I've been doing had figures in them. And I thought, I want to do them without figures. And then like, well, what kind of images don't have figures in, you know, and landscapes can, but don't have to have figures in them. And still life don't have figures in them. That was like, it's almost like it's a condition of still life. Because if it's got a figure in it, then it's a portrait.
Yes.
Or if you've got multiple figures in it, then it's something else. But if it's just objects without figures, then it's a still life. And so I was starting to think about, well, what makes that what it is? But also, you know, my first intuition, like a lot of people, is, well, what's interesting about still life? It's kind of not interesting. And so then I couldn't make the montages until I worked out what was interesting about still life.
So this feature, in a way, is your thinking on and making it interesting for yourself. I mean, you've certainly applied.
Yeah, well, so it comes out. So like I was saying, so I'm doing the work, but then that forces me to do some research. And then the research kind of fills me with excitement about certain things. And then when I'm in the studio, I don't stop that excitement. I go with it. And then I'm, you know, looking through magazines and I'm like, wow. That looks like, you know, that looks like a Cezanne, or some version of a concept of still life that I've recently become aware of. And so I want to work with that and play with that and try and maybe draw something out of it. So it might be, you know, it might be that the photographer isn't even interested in still life. It might be that they're taking product photos for advertising, you know, but also I'm looking at their photograph and I'm thinking there's a history of painting in that photograph that they may or may not know about, but I know about. And so I can work with that. And so So the two things kind of develop in a sort of staggered, weird relationship to each other where, you know, at one point I've got no understanding, but some visual things are going on. And at other points, the visual stuff is like dragging me out into thinking more and reading more and having conversations with people about these things to try and catch up with the work in a way. And so it's this strange dance between theory and practice that kind of that often pushes me on to write something for Art Monthly.
Well, it's very valuable. I'm an artist as well, so it's really valuable to hear your process of thinking and making, because you know, you do hear it from people, of course, but it's a bit of a kind of sometimes unmentioned thing. And you have always been involved with writing and teaching, as well as working with other people as artists and working on your own work. I mean, for me, you working on your own as an artist is a sort of a new thing, I feel.
Yeah, it is.
So that's an interesting thing for me as well. So getting back to the feature, which you don't have to do particularly, but you say you were researching the figural representation of working class women in still life. So and I know you've moved to still life, but the class aspect of that interests me again as well, because obviously I know we've talked about class before. And what why were you, what was there a reason you were particularly looking at working class women in still life?
I'm in the early process of writing a book on not just working class figures, but for one chapter on here, working class figures of working class women in avant-garde art, because I was really taken by this kind of it's now very canonic art historical sort of dialogue between T.J. Clark and Griselda Pollock, where, you know, T.J. Clark's looking at Manet and Van Gogh and people like that, and he's looking at those He doesn't actually specify this in the way that Griselda Pollock accuses him of, but in Griselda Pollock, she says he's looking at these through class, and she's going to look at them through gender instead.
Right.
But what happens is that he's actually not, you know, when he's looking at Manet's Olympia, he's looking at it through the class of the potential client of Olympia. He doesn't look at it through a kind of, you know, an analysis or a social history of prostitutes in France. That's not, you know, he's thinking, what does it mean for a man, a bourgeois man, to be standing in front of this painting at the salon? Do you know what I mean?
And yeah.
So there's a class element to it, but there's also a class element that's missing from it, which right. is, you know, I mean, first of all, that you know, if you think that there's a difference between the model who is depicting Olympia, who is, you know, a courtesan, and the actual population of prostitutes at the time, then this is just a figure. This is not a picture of a prostitute. It's a figure of a prostitute. And real images of prostitutes at that time don't look like that. You know, documentary images of prostitutes at that time don't look like that. So there's this missing element of working class women, which are essential to understanding, from my perspective, those kinds of paintings. But also, in a sense, that whole history of early modernism, early avant-gardism. Because as soon as I noticed that, I then start to look around, and you see that. It's not just the prostitute that gets represented in that period in France. It's also figures like the laundress. You know, Degas, for instance, painted a lot of laundress paintings, and you know, because this was like a new development in a bourgeois household, is that you send out, well, it started out that you had one, but then it was like they became these almost like little factories, laundry factories that your clothes would go there and then they'd come back, and you know, and they would be carried in the streets by laundresses. But then it turns out, you know, as some social historians and art historians have pointed out since T.J. Clark and Griselda Pollock, that these like little sort of factories for laundresses were so hot that they would take some of their clothes off to work, and bourgeois men, as they're wandering down the street, would just, and all the doors and the windows are open to trying to get rid of the heat, and they just linger, you know. So there was this kind of set of meanings around the laundress, which you don't necessarily get that explicitly in a Degas painting of a laundress. But then when you know that history, you look at those paintings and you start to see something else going on, because, you know, maybe they've undone some of their buttons or something like that. And it's kind of, you know, and then you know that history. So you know that it's like, this is maybe the beginning of the day. And this is, you know, anyway. And there's this.
I've got you to digress, as they say, but it's fine.
Yeah. So I was looking at these figures, and then I noticed that there were also not just pictures of a laundress or of a prostitute, but there were pictures of things in relationship to them. And so then I was kind of really interested in, like, because these are not actual, you know, Degas' paintings of laundresses were not of actual laundresses. They were of models that he staged. So then the staging is everything. So you can take the figure out. So then I started looking for still life paintings of these figures, you know, prostitutes, laundresses, wet nurses, and so on and so forth. And they're not that many, but I did find some. And when I did, it changed my thinking around those still life. So some of them I was already aware of, but I hadn't connected them, you know. So that's where that came from. I was thinking about working class women in relation to figures, and then that in relation to still life.
And then at some point, you were, I would say lucky, but it's just the way that things go. There were two exhibitions that occurred, which you mentioned early on in your feature. There was the one at the Courthold of Wayne Thiebaud, which I hope I say correctly, and then
Thiebaud.
Yeah. Yes, I mean I've known the work sort of for years, really, and sort of think of it as some of it as being out of the pop world of the 60s, but he was one of an early pop artists, you could say, but I know he's not only seen that way. And also another show, Joy Gregory's exhibition Catching Flies with Honey at the Whitechapel, organised also by Arnold Feeney Bristol. Then these two shows connected with what you were thinking about, I understand, because they did involve, well, you could apply your still life thinking.
Yeah, so it's more straightforward with the Thiebaud, because the exhibition at the Courthold is it's specifically selected to be a still life exhibition, and they've titled the exhibition American Still Life. So that was kind of straightforward in a way. The Joy Gregory less so, because there's a much broader range of works in that exhibition. Not even 50% of it is still life, but the still life that was there was so different from the Wayne Thiebaud still life that I just spent forever in there sort of puzzling, you know, what is the difference between these two still lives?
Would Joy have thought of her work as still life? Do you think it's a phrase she would have applied to?
Well, she does. So in some of the I don't know, what do you call it? The information panels.
Yeah.
They're very small. They're kind of like titles, but with a little bit more information on them. She uses the word still life. So one of the series of images is called Constructed Interiors / Still Life. Still lives, and then she's got others which are kind of related to still life. So there's a series of works called Objects of Beauty and Girl Thing. So there's this kind of relationship between figures and things and objects, and as if we can understand the figures through the objects that are related to them, and that's what kind of made me think there's something here for me to think about.
You describe still life. Can you just run through what still, so that we're clear what we mean, what you do in your features, for me is really deeply analyze really what still life, its history of what it has been, and then you kind of go into these artists and analyze theirs and the differences between types of still life. Well, you talk about how it's conventionally divided into subgenres of its differing inventories. I mean, that's really interesting. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. So this is pretty conventional art history, really. In a sense, it's like the kind of art history that you would be taught before they introduced the sort of, you know, new art history, social art history, and so on. That you're analysing the pictures and what they represent. And so that there's the classic subgenres of still life would be, you know, it feels very silly saying it really, but you know, fruit.
Sorry to make you do that.
Game, which is birds and pears and things like that, and banquets, vanitas, scientific curiosities, and one that I had to look up. I'd never come across this before. When you see still lives that consist of things like eggs, cheese, and bread, they're known as breakfast still lives.
Wow.
Which doesn't fit with my concept of breakfast, but that's what they're called.
Sure.
In art history. Now, I don't, and you know, there are the different subgenres of still life kind of have their own histories, you know. So If you read Bryson's book on Bryson's classic book on still life, then he'll tell you that the first still lifes were of raw ingredients, you know,
what, meat or fish or
so it's mostly, it starts out as kind of things that you can harvest directly from a field, so like grapes,
right?
But I think this is only a half memory, but I think when I read it, I think that he included bread in that list of raw things, and I just remember getting a little bit peeved.
Yeah, it's not quite right,
bread
is it?
Isn't raw.
I don't find bread lying around in fields much.
Yeah, it might be that bread isn't included in the very earliest still lives. And the first still lives were painted directly on walls, not as, you know.
So in rooms.
In rooms. So he says that the first still lives are painted in these like annex type rooms next to some, you know, wealthy person's house. So it's for strangers to, in a sense, benefit from the hospitality of the house without entering the house.
Right.
So it's a way of including and excluding them at the same time. And the paintings of fruit and similar things would actually be accompanied by real examples of food that they could eat, right? So these still lives are very then they're of natural things.
Yes.
So it's not until later, Bryson points out, that you get a still life with something in it like a cup or a saucer, because they're not natural. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're as natural as bread, but they're not natural. So there's this second generation of still life, in a way, which contains utensils. And in a sense, once you get to paintings of scientific curiosities, globes, shells, minerals, books, manuscripts, and things like that, then we're in a kind of whole new world of still life where there's nothing natural in that picture at all.
And the meaning between the objects might be thought about by the way they're arranged, and you know, they have to have a sort of meaning that others can read, perhaps, whether directly, I don't know. But also the rooms. You mentioned that, you know, these things are then, you've mentioned, you know, a room on the edge of a house, as it were, but they could be in a living room or a dining room or a kitchen or a study, and that has a big effect upon the meaning as well, you say, don't you?
Yeah. So this is my reflection on it, really. So because Bryson talks about these different still lives all existing in the same space, which he says is the space of the kitchen, not of the table. Now, the table might be in different rooms, but he thinks they're all unified by the fact that they're all on a table. And then I started looking at how these tables were different kinds of tables and in different kinds of rooms. And there's a difference between a kitchen table and a dining table and a desk in an office or a study or something like that. So I was really interested in these different places where still life belongs. And that's what ultimately led to me thinking about the still life scape as a opposed to just the still life. So I'm not thinking so much about the objects, I'm thinking about the spaces that the objects conjure up when we look at them.
So the scape is the room or the place, the placing, where it's placed. Well, is that what you mean?
It started there for me, but then I remembered several years ago reading Meir Shapiro writing about modern art, and he's thinking of cubist still life and another still life that comes after cubism. And he says that there's a difference between modern still life and traditional still life, and that modern still life for him is more likely to be staged in the living room and to contain personal objects. So in a sense, the still life becomes a kind of portrait.
Right.
Because these are the objects that refer to a very individual kind of life.
Yeah, a way of life, and maybe a specific person.
Exactly. And so he says that these are effectively kind of these are not so the so we add layers to it. So it's like it's in the living room, it's of a particular person, but that person is of a particular class. And so then in a sense the scape part of it gets bigger and bigger.
Right.
Because the living room is a particular place, but the person in the living room, their life exists outside the living room. So you've got this whole biography which goes in and out of that room, and that biography is part of a society and a whole kind of social structure. And so the scape part of the still life gets bigger and bigger the more you kind of locate it in its context. So in that sense, the room is only the beginning of the construction of what the still lifescape is.
Yeah, because you say it would also extend to the infrastructures, ecologies, histories, systems and structures that reproduce the divisions of labour, modes of exchange and spatial configurations that are presupposed in still life. So, you can go on, you can analyse it deeply, can't you? And the more you look, the more you can construct a very complicated meaning or reading.
And some people would want to do that, and that's the kind of person that I am. I want to do that. Some people wouldn't want to do that. They might want to put a kind of edge on their investigation and say, you know, I'm not looking beyond the table, or I'm not looking beyond the room.
Yeah.
And you know, that's what this is. But I'm kind of, you know, I'm more. I don't know. I like to do it. Keep going and see where that takes me. So I'm kind of, you know, to what extent does, you know, there's that famous Paula Modison Becker painting, Still Life with Fried Eggs. And, you know, generally when people write about that painting, they say, you know, obviously, you know, this is painted in the studio where she's painting. And it's a frying pan with fried eggs in it. She's made herself a meal in the studio, and that's probably factually accurate. But I was kind of, if you dig deeper, like into, you know, the way that Mayor Shapiro would, in a sense, well, I felt encouraged by Mayor Shapiro to do this, to say, well, let's connect that to her life then. And so I read about her. And I found out that her entire life she had a maid, more than one maid,
and she couldn't cook till she was 20 anyway.
And she only learned to cook because her family thought that she should learn to cook before getting married. So, in a sense, it's like her cooking eggs for herself. It's like, you know, this is exists within literature as at the time as well, of how the difference between different kinds of eggs kind of signifies. And she's cooked the simplest way of cooking eggs, you know, the least skilled way of cooking eggs, and the easiest and the quickest. And it's like that maybe signals to some people that she's just very keen to get back to her painting, which is fine. But it could also mean that she's actually signaling in this painting that she does not waste time on cooking. That's beneath her, you know. And normally she would have a maid doing this, but she, you know, today she's doing it herself, which is like taking a holiday from who you are. And, you know, it's like camping, you know what I mean? So this expresses something much more complex than, this is an artist cooking a meal for themselves.
Well, you actually describe it as reproductive labour, the cooking of these eggs.
Yeah.
Which I think, because it's interesting, you're bringing in, you know, these whole things, aren't you, about who's done the work or what work does it signify. But you also talk about, I mean, this thing of rooms. You mentioned Walter Benjamin and he was a Marxist, as you say.
Yeah.
you talk about private interiors and commercial interiors and the home and the office. And then, you know, obviously with Wayne Thiebaud, there's tell me what you identified about his painting, because obviously they're set in a very particular, and he's American, painting in the, I think, late 50s and 60s particularly. I mean, he did live to 101 apparently, so he only died not that long ago really, which I thought was amazing. But anyway, talk about his work a little bit in relation to this, if you would.
So I was really interested in the idea that, you know, this was like a continuation of my rereading of Bryson. Is I was looking at it thinking, well, these are on tables. Some of them are, you know. So you could just say they're a continuation of the history of still life, their conventional still life, their still life, the way still life's always been done, except that these tables are not in any of the rooms that historically still life has been in. They're not in the kitchen. They're not in the living room. They're not in the dining room. They're not in the study. They're in a shop. And so that seemed to be worth thinking about. What does it mean when still life is in a shop and not in a house? And how does the artist work with that? And what is that related to? And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, we've already had images of shops, you know, but they've not been done by painters. They've been done by photographers. So photographers have, you know, photographed public life, life on the streets, you know, and one of the ways that they've done that is to photograph shop windows. And Thiebaud's paintings are in effect of shop windows, or the equivalent, you know, like the display of goods to a potential customer, which is sometimes is in the shop window, sometimes on the counter, and on a you know, it could be on a shelf or something else. But there's this display of goods to a passing public, which is, you know, if you're a photographer, you are the passing public, but if you're a painter, you generally aren't. And so I was really intrigued by what is the relationship then between these paintings and the history of documentary photography as opposed to the history of painting. And how do those two different traditions come together in this?
Now, I don't know if he used photography as a basis for the painting or not.
Well, I didn't know either. but I did find out that he would take photographs when he walked around. So he did take photographs when he walked around the streets, all right, but his method, when he described his method of painting, was that he would go out, he would see something and he would look at it, and then he would go back to the studio and he'd paint it from memory.
Okay.
And he wanted it to be done from memory, and because then you get a different kind of character of the object.
I mean, he paints, just so listeners know, I mean, we're talking about work, say there might be just a single slice of a very nice gâteau or something like that, placed centrally in its cooling display case, painted in quite thick paint, really, but with great accuracy and in a way, aren't they? But quite stylistically, he was very consistent painter, often quite pastel colors, but you could say, I don't know.
Degree. Like Californian sunny day.
Yeah, like everything would melt if it had a chance.
Yeah. And when people think about Thiebaud and write about Thiebaud, they kind of, it's very difficult for people to get beyond the style, beyond the technique, beyond the aesthetic, because there's so much to say there that you kind of you're going to run out of page.
So what did you say that was? What did you say was different then?
I ignored the style and the technique.
Good for you,
because I was just really interested in this. What I thought was, what kind of encounter is this? You know, so when you paint a still life and it's in a kitchen, then what I think generally, you know, so when Chardin paints a still life of raw materials, you know, things that could be cooked but haven't been cooked yet, you know, on a kitchen table, this is a workplace, you know. Somebody is going to pick up that work, if it's someone in a family or whether it's a servant or a professional chef, whatever. someone is going to pick that stuff up and turn it into something to eat.
And they may have dug it up in their garden as well. The other thing was it's not necessarily a bought item. It could be.
No, it's not.
Yeah, it could be their own production that produced
it. There's always some implied social relationship or personal relationship when you're depicting these objects. And I was wondering, what is the social relationship? What is the encounter in a way in Thibaut paintings? And in a downstairs room at the Courtauld, they have some like early prints that he made. And one of them was I think it's just called Breakfast. And there's a plate, and then, you know, you can see like there's a sausage or bacon and there's an egg and things like that on this plate with a knife and fork either side of it, ready to be eaten. And it's difficult to tell from the picture, but it's been depicted, I think, from a memory of either standing or sitting in front of that plate. So it's the moment before you eat it.
Or consumption.
And maybe what he's interested in is making that moment last forever, that you never eat it.
Well, it's a bit like you're looking at the cake in the shop as well.
Yeah.
Pre-consumption. But there's a difference between the one at home and the one in the shop, isn't there, that you draw out?
Yeah, because that is a moment of decision. Is if you're standing in front of an object in a shop and you've not consumed it, then the chances are that you are wondering whether to buy it, or it depends on your taste, but you know, if you go to a car showroom and you're looking at cars that you can't afford, then you would also be in a similar situation of looking at something that you're not going to consume. So I was interested in that kind of, in a sense, there's like the shop as a place of encounter doesn't discriminate between people who can buy and people who can't. We can all look at the same stuff.
Well, the funny thing is,
it discriminates later on in the process when somebody actually can or can't purchase it.
Yes.
So it seems like he's depicting that moment.
Yeah. But also, when you're looking in a shop window, or especially an arrangement in a shop window, I think they are like still lifes.
Yeah.
Aren't they? I mean, because there's a flat plane and there's a window and you can't touch it, so it's like a picture. So they're not dissimilar.
No, which is strange that still life took so long to catch on that shops were doing this already. But I think that's one of the things that's appealing to Thibaut about shops and shop fronts and shelves in shops and things like that, and cafes and, you know, all the other places that he goes to, diners and things like that, is that they are spaces of display. And so they're already a picture. You don't have to construct a picture. You don't have to compose it. It's already there. So it's like a ready-made.
Well, yeah, he's
like a photograph, like a snapshot.
He's viewing the object as you, it from the same position as you do when you're thinking of buying it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly. Bring out, you mentioned Warhol and the difference, because obviously Warhol is involved with, well, you say mechanical reproduction, but that's partly to do with the way he produced the image using repeated screen printing. And even though they're one-offs, they're still screen printed, aren't they? But the objects, say like baked bean tins, all these other, there is an interesting difference between T-Bird and him, isn't there? You do say a little bit about it.
Although you mentioned the single piece of pie, it's actually more typical of Thibaut to have, you know, like a whole, you know, like display of pies or display of cakes or display of sausages or something like that. And you've got all these
competition
objects in front of you, which is, yeah, that moment of choice. So it's not just the question of like, do I want something to eat? Can I afford something to eat? Also, which of these things would I eat? You know, so you're in this position of choice. And so there's this repetition in front of you. And Andy Warhol did do repetition, but it would be the same tin of beans repeated over and over again, or the same tin of soup repeated over and over again. And the repetition in Thibaut is more like a kind of a repetition of, you know, that kind of capitalist abundance, which is like, you know, when you know, in effect, if you think about this in the way that I was talking about before, the still lifescape aspect, then the chances are at this particular diner, these cakes have been produced by different companies, different people in different parts of the city, maybe some of them outside the city. So then they become geographically much more dispersed than a single tin of baked beans that is repeated. I mean, even with, like, if you're going to do Heinz soup, all these different varieties of Heinz soup possibly come from the same factory. But in the case of Thibaut, they it's like it implies a much bigger economy than that. And we might be in this one place, but there's all of these other people, you know, sometimes maybe quite small businesses, maybe one person businesses making cakes or making biscuits or whatever they are. And this shop is the is the outlet for what they're doing. So you've got this entire community.
Right. Implied in the painting.
Looking at. Yeah. That's implied in the painting. So yeah. It's a different kind of repetition.
Yeah.
Because I think that when I talked about the mechanical reproduction in Warhol, I wasn't only thinking about his technique. I was thinking about what he's responding to, I think, is print technology. So, like, you know, the same image, you know, like the image of someone of a superstar like Marilyn is repeated over and over again in magazines or in newspapers. And
yeah.
He's interested in that kind of repetition.
It is different.
The same
though.
Image is multiplied.
Yeah.
And that's not the kind of repetition that you get in Thibaut. He's not interested in the repetition of images. He's interested in the multiplication of things, of commodities.
Yes. Listen, we've not got loads of time left. And we haven't talked much about Joy Gregory's work, really. I was fascinated.
Well, when I first went in, because I saw the Wayne Thibaut before I saw the Joy Gregory.
Right.
And the Thibaut kind of confirmed everything I'd been thinking about in terms of still life and its relationship to social history. And then I went to the Joy Gregory exhibition, and it challenged everything that I thought about still life. It wasn't, for instance, you know, her images are usually of objects that are completely isolated from context. So, you know, that there's one that gets printed in the magazine, which is called Eyelashes. And it's, you know, it's a print from the Objects of Beauty series. And it's a false eyelash. But it kind of fills the whole space.
It's sort of a white background. There's nothing. Yeah, it's not. There's no context, is there?
There's nothing. It's not on a table. It's not on a dresser. It, you know, you can't. Is it in a bedroom? Is it? You know, where is it? Is it in a? You know, a bathroom? Is it out and about? Is it in a club? Is it in a restaurant? You know, where is this located? And it's kind of. So it takes away that, and in a sense, it sort of, you then have to find another route, which is like, it's not the Meyer Shapiro route of like embedding it in its physical context in order to find its social context. It doesn't have a physical context. So then I was kind of, I was trying to understand what links all of these objects. What kind of, in a sense, it's not about building up an image of place, but building up an image of identity or of life or of a certain kind of an imaginary of what it means to be, I don't know, a woman or a black person or, you know, to be, I don't know, like stylish or groomed or those kind of things, you know. And it's like, and what are they embedded in? And they're not embedded in place exactly. They're embedded in discourses and in cultures and in shared lifestyles. But the really big, so the first big contrast for me was this space thing, but then that led on to another one, which is which is that Tebow's objects are placed in a shop and our commodity is ready for sale just before sale. And Joy Gregory's objects are hers. If she bought them, we don't know. But if she did, that was a long time ago. These are her things. These are not commodities. These are belongings. And that makes a big difference in terms of what they mean when you're looking at them. Because when you're looking at them, you know, you're not the person standing in front of a shop saying, you know, do I want this? Is this something that I want to spend my money on? You're looking at Joy Gregory's things. You know what I mean? So that's what I was thinking at first when I was looking at those.
They're quite particular. I believe they're Cali type prints, which is a very particular kind of photographic iron silver process. I'm not pretending to understand it, but it's obviously very sensitively presented and sensitively photographed. And she thought really hard about what kind of print it will be. So there's a preciousness, a care almost, to her observation of that one object, you know, and then the fineness of the eyelashes is, you know, really can see it, and it's quite extreme, isn't it? And obviously she's probably worn it or is about to wear it.
Exactly.
It has a, exactly. I don't know.
Possibly several times, you know.
Yes, yes.
These things in Joy Gregory's works are things that matter. And so they have a whole other set of meanings. And what's interesting is I think that she's selecting things. It's very difficult to tell just from looking at it. Is she selecting things because they really matter to her? Or is she selecting things that she has that she thinks will matter to others? And it's basically impossible to tell from looking. But she would know. But we don't necessarily know when we look at it. We just know that it is right on that edge between things that matter to her and things that matter to others. And they matter because they are shared, they're common, you know. I mean, I personally have never worn a fake eyelash, but I know people that do, and I notice it, and it's part of my culture. I know that this happens, and I, in a sense, I can understand its meaning. Do you know what I mean?
She gives it value by the attention.
She does, but
doesn't
also
she as well?
By its connection to other things. So in the Objects of Beauty series, there's also things like there's a hairbrush, and a pair of scissors.
But together, these images all make a... I mean, in a way, they are a series of works, which perhaps...
They are.
They have a greater meaning.
So when you look at those connections, when you try and, in a sense, turn them into a set and say, what is this a set of, you know, then it's a set of objects that she uses and other women use in order to become who they are.
Yeah, you quote Stuart Hall and saying the way the black body has been locked into certain codes of representing black femininity, masculinity. I'm not saying that specifically. I don't even know if he was talking about her work specifically there, but they may be that she's representing things which are codes or objects which have a code to others.
I think, you know, that they are the... they are the objects and instruments related to, you know, which in a sense are how, if you want to think about it in terms of the way that Stuart Hall talked about it, the way that the black body makes itself into the black body. So the black body then becomes not this inert, given, passive thing, but it's something that is formed and shaped, and not formed and shaped just by discourse or formed and shaped by other people, but formed and shaped by yourself and through your own activity, you know. And that's what these objects speak of, really, which is what Carol Tulloch calls style narratives. You know, it's...
Say that word again.
Style narratives.
Style narratives, got it.
So your your own, you could say you have your own personal style narrative, which is like, this is, you know, I first started to use this kind of comb at this time in my life, or the first time I wore eyelashes was this time in my life. So you got your own personal narrative, but that personal narrative is embedded in much longer, broader narratives of a community of people who, you know, maybe there's a longer social history, and you could say Caribbean people started to use these kinds of hairbrushes at this particular time. But that's not when you first started doing it. You started doing it later than that. So there's these different scales of narrative, and style narrative for Carol Tulloch is a way of meshing those kind of biographical narratives into these social historical narratives, and therefore link your body, your image, yourself to a whole community of selves and a history of a people.
You say a history and a world, so it gets even bigger, yeah. Which is great.
Exactly, and the world then gets us back to the scape. You know, so we're, yes, talking then about these objects are in a world, and therefore these still lives are in fact still lifescapes.
But obviously the important point, I mean, in a way, because part of me thinks, oh golly, you know, you could just make works, you just take any object, say, that belongs to yourself or part of your life, and you just the value that these have is has to be brought to them partly. I mean, they're like being offered up for careful analysis and thought by the artist. In other words, we consider it because they're giving it so much attention, but all the meaning is like we almost have to bring it or yeah. That's how I feel about it. Because in a way, you just think, well, hang on, it's just an eyelash. It's funny, really, but then it has all this other meaning. But you have to bring it, like your analysis through this feature, is doing that.
Yeah. So one of the reasons why I wanted to write this article is because when I went to the Tebow exhibition, I felt, yes, I'm on top of this. I understand what still life is, and I know how to read it, and, you know, and I know it relates to its own history and so forth. And then when I went to the Joy Gregor exhibition, I was like, I was shook by it. And I was like, I don't understand. This isn't like the history of still life. What is it? What do I need to do that's different? And when you start piecing together those individual objects into lives and histories and worlds, then I found that they were like, I don't know, like the hairs went up on the back of my neck. It was like, it was a totally different kind of experience of still life, which is, this is a still life, which is right on the edge of things. You know, this is a still life, which like makes a difference. It like, it's part of struggle. This is, yeah, part of a kind of, you know, these are, I don't know, you could say these are anti-racist still lives, or, you know, these are civil rights still lives, or these are, you know, Black Lives Matter still lives, or these are feminist still lives. And so they become part of something that matters in a very different way from the Wayne Tebow, you know, in a way that like really sort of, I don't know, like captures my attention in a much more effective, emotional kind of way, because I'm you know, I then become involved in it in a much more sort of animated way.
Well, also you're learning something perhaps about some aspect of culture that you don't know about, and being shown it and giving importance to something that, and you learn from it. Basically, I think of Tebow also as being a sort of almost celebrating, you know, the shopping and buying, the American way. It's almost like a kind of, I mean, like, they are seductive things and they're lovely paintings and the skill is brilliant and all that, but they are kind of, it's like, and they do reflect a time in America or America very well. So they do all those good things, but they are a celebration in a way. They're not a kind of criticism, yeah, I don't feel. Whereas, you know, Joy Gregory's work is a criticism in a way, because it's fighting to be seen by making itself. Do you know what I mean? Hopefully that isn't necessarily always going to be the case. She went to Johannesburg. We've got a couple of minutes, yes. But she went to Johannesburg. She did what I think is called the Handbag Project, which is a great name for a project, by the way. But
which I think is an ongoing project.
Okay,
so,
right.
So it did start there, but I think that when she gets the chance, she adds to it. So she found these secondhand, expensive handbags in South Africa after apartheid, and so that's got a story in itself, you know, which is
whose were they?
You know, you can imagine, you know, these are the handbags of white women in, you know, in elite society in apartheid, and for whatever reason they've not held on to them. And is that because they left? Is that what, you know, so
what's the story?
And then these handbags suddenly come onto the secondhand market. And so they're these kind of fascinating things, because they also, in a very different way, combine the biographical and the historical, because they once belonged to individuals, but then kind of like, as collectively they escape from those individuals and then re-enter the world.
Does she present them as objects singularly?
As prints, yeah, so individual prints of each
individual. Each handbag, like almost like a kind of documentary of a book.
Yeah, so like a portrait in the form of an object. Which is a portrait of someone we don't know, because that part of it, the story, is missing. These become like windows, I guess, or something like that, for you to see that world, and they speak about that entire period of apartheid. They are apartheid objects.
The social life of things.
Yes, exactly.
You say that at the end.
But this social life of things is at once biographical and historical, and so they feed into each other. There's no way of isolating one from the other, and that's what I think is so important about the handbag project. It's you only pick them up to make art out of them if you think this is a significant object. It is, because it is like it's rooted in a world, and that world is still worth thinking about, because even though South African apartheid is formally over, there's still apartheid in the world, and apartheid needs to be thought about. And this is a poignant, I guess that's the word, isn't it? This is a poignant series of images. And what makes them poignant is the relationship between the objects, the people, and the world that those people lived in.
We've spoken for an hour. Thank you so much. And I hope the listeners have enjoyed the conversation and are encouraged to read Dave Beach's feature in Art Monthly's March 2026 issue, number 494. And I'm sure Dave will come on the show again. But thanks so much, Dave. You've been on a number of times, and every time it's really enjoyable and very valuable. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you for listening to the Art Monthly talk show. Do remember that you can subscribe to Art Monthly by going to our website buy page. That's www.artmonthly.co.uk. There are many options, including full digital subscription with access to our archive going back to 1976, as well as print options. Also, you can do both if you wish. In other words, you can receive the magazine and have access to the full archive. But thanks again for listening to the Art Monthly talk show. This is your host, Matt Hale. Goodbye.